Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
What are we to make of the temple envisioned by Ezekiel? How can we better understand Ezekiel chapters 40 through 48? One way, suggests Tova Gonzel, is by examining evidence from Babylonian sources. She argues that Neo-Babylonian temples provide a meaningful backdrop against which many unique features of Ezekiel's vision should be interpreted. Tune in as we speak with Tova Gonzel about her recent book, Ezekiel's Visionary Temple in Babylonian Context. You're listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. And I'm your host, Michael Morales. Dr. Tova Gonzel received her PhD from the Department of Bible in Bar-Ilan and has published widely on prophetic literature in the context of the larger ancient Near Eastern world. Tova, welcome back to New Books in Biblical Studies.
Thanks for inviting me here again. It's always exciting.
So again, this is your second episode with us, and you introduced yourself a bit before, but what else can you tell us about yourself? Does your family enjoy the book of Ezekiel as much as you do? And what would you say is your next favorite book of the Bible, perhaps after Ezekiel?
Well, you asked two different questions. The first question was about my family. So I would say that I think they don't have any, they're not engaged with Ezekiel in any way. I don't even know which of my children know exactly what the text of Ezekiel says. Probably some to a certain extent, but it would be an interesting thing for me to find an opportunity to check out in an indirect way if I want a direct answer. And with regarding to what would be the second favorite book, it probably, I don't know, I'm engaged with Ezra and Nehemiah, and I feel that they're very interesting and that they are challenging in different ways too. So maybe that would be my answer. But it's sometimes I feel connection to rabbinic texts or to Hebrew literature texts. It's not all about Bible. So
what prompted you to look at Babylonian sources for understanding Ezekiel's temple vision?
I think that's an excellent question. I think, I'm actually an Orthodox Jew, which means that I pray more than once a day. And we always have these texts in our praying that deal with a future Jerusalem, a future dwelling of God in Jerusalem and in the temple. And, you know, bears to mind, what is that sacred space that we're talking about and we kind of make a daily mention of and kind of bypass it? So I think years ago when I was trying to figure out what exactly am I praying about or saying or what should I be imagining when I say these passages, that's, I think, what got me started. Times passed and I've gone a long way, but you are asking where my starting point was. I think it was probably two or three decades ago when I was just first, you know, trying to figure out what exactly is this that I'm devoting time to every day. But then once I became an academic and I started, learning more biblical texts, and I started learning the book of Ezekiel, and it was after my doctorate. My doctorate really does not deal with these nine chapters at all. If you would look back at the doctorate that I finished in 2005, when I worked on the concept of holiness in the book of Ezekiel, it goes through many chapters in the book, but basically it doesn't reach the visionary temple. which was kind of situated already then in the scholarship as a separate unit. So I didn't really reach to it. And then once after I finished and I started looking at these chapters, I saw that it's very interesting because there are many elements in this temple vision that actually lack biblical parallels. And I think trying to understand where they come from and how should we understand why there are these differences and if and why they're significant was what really brought me to ask about the Babylonian backdrop.
Could you give us any example of how similarities with Babylonian temples help explain features of the temple in Ezekiel?
Yeah, I guess I can, but maybe I'll start with actually one thing that demonstrates that these chapters are so unique, and that's the reason you really have to go on looking for a different context to kind of understand it. And that is that when we read the prophetic literature, we're used to seeing a certain model of leadership. We're used to seeing, at least in the first temple time, we're used to seeing a king, we're used to seeing a prophet, a high priest. And then you reach these chapters in Ezekiel and there's no king and there's no mention of a high priest. If the only prophet that we acknowledge is Ezekiel himself. And instead we have a whole bunch of different roles. One of them is the Nasi, which is a very dominant figure. The name Nasi is a name that we already know from the biblical texts, but we've never really met him with a job description that fits the way that Ezekiel puts him. So to respond to your question, I think that actually looking for a temple administrator that's not a king is a good example of something that we see in the Neo-Babylonian temples, but also in the temples in the first millennium in general, but specifically the Neo-Babylonian time, where you really can see there's a temple administrator that is not a priest, and Ezekiel's Nasi is not a priest. And he really has a lot of the, I would say, responsibility for maintaining the rituals, the sacrifices, making sure that everything that has to be taken care of in the temple is really carried out. Another example that we can see is really looking at Ezekiel's visionary temple. We can see that this is someone who's very familiar with a functioning temple. The many chambers, details in many different ways. And when you look at a functioning temple and you try to find some kind of parallel, it's hard to understand from the 400 years of the first temple and the 600 years of the second temple, it's hard to find an example besides the last years of the second temple that we have more literature on, but it's way post-biblical times, really descriptions that can demonstrate how a building of a temple was built, what details did it need to have, what was definitely included, what could have been included, what was necessary for the priests to really be able to carry out their sacrifices and everything included. So I guess personnel would be one answer to your question, and the layout of the temple would be another answer to your question.
Are there any major differences between Ezekiel's temple and those of Babylon?
So I would first say that what's very striking in Ezekiel's temple is what it lacks. Now, every time that I talk about something that the temple's lacking, you can always say, well, it was there, and it's so obvious that it was there that the verses don't mention it. And I actually don't have a good answer for that, meaning that's something that we can discuss if the verses don't mention something like a menorah. Does that mean that this temple really did not have a menorah? Or does that mean that this was taken for granted, that any Jewish temple must have a menorah and it doesn't have to be mentioned? My personal opinion is that what the verses don't describe is actually missing, especially because the book devotes 63 verses to describe walls and courtyards and gates and You know, you wonder if a book can elaborate in such length about gates and courtyards and walls, to describe the building itself, then there must be more to it than just to say, oh, the menorah is taken for granted. That doesn't, you know, it doesn't really work. So this was a brief introduction to the difference that you asked about, because part of what's different is that we're lacking temple vessels. I mean, we have a small altar, we have a table. I would say that's the bare minimum to actually have a sacrifice, right? Someone wants to sacrifice a sacrifice, then without an altar, you can't really do that. And without a table, you can't really do that. So that's why I would call that the bare minimum. But anything else, gold, silver, I would say magnifying decorations, things that you expect to have in temples that really usually, all these decorations usually say something about the status of the king and of the god that rules this temple. And the fact that it's all lacking is really a very big difference between this Jewish Jerusalem temple and the Babylonian temples. So I would say that's one example. I can give more examples, but I think that the fact that we don't have significant temple vessels, gold, silver, also means that, and here comes the second difference, is that it also means that we don't have people knocking at the doors of the temple. There's not a lot to see. So instead of being a temple that everyone comes to see the decorations and through the uniqueness of the gold and the silver and the whatever it would be, the vessels or the statues or the decorations or the curtains or whatever it would be, through that really understand how strong, large, and capable the god of this temple is, what we have here is this temple that's really no attraction to anyone. There's obviously a theological reason for that difference, but you didn't ask about that.
All right, so what's the theological reason for that difference?
I would say that there are two ways to look at it. One way to look at it is to look at the Israelites' history and understand that this is really supposed to be some kind of repairing or some kind of, I would even call it a new, trying to set the stage with a totally different criteria for what a temple is, a Jewish temple is, because the first one was destroyed. And when God wants to make sure that this temple will really be kept holy and will be significant only as a dwelling, as a place for God's honor to situate itself, then one of the things that we can see is that it has to be kept totally holy. It cannot be impure in any way. And to do so, you really build a temple that's not an attraction to anyone. So the first theological response in my mind would be that this is the way that this temple is ensured to be kept holy forever. And as an outcome, that when God finally comes into it, he won't leave. That's what the verses tell us. That's really what the verses say. I would add to that also that I think that there is a component here of really differentiating this temple from the Babylonian temples, meaning it's like to say, we're not in this race. You know, like when all the temples around there are in this race, I'm bigger, I'm nicer, I'm prettier, I have more silver, I have more gold, I'm taller, I'm higher. I also have a tomb that's built like a temple, and so on and so on. The Jewish God basically detaches himself and says, I'm not part of this. My glory, my strength, the recognition of my capabilities do not correspond with how beautiful or big my palace/temple is. And that's not new theologically, because there is no Babylonian or Assyrian temple that claimed to be strong even though his people were defeated. It always went together with, you know, you're strong, you're capable, so you protect your land and you protect your key people. And only the Jewish God says, I'm strong, I'm capable, but my people sinned, so they have to go to exile. My people sinned, so my land will be empty. That's really a totally new and different theological notion. We're not familiar with that anywhere in the ancient Near Eastern world or in the Mesopotamian concepts of a god. So I would just say that this temple takes these concepts one step further, meaning there's an empty land, even though God is strong. The temple is destroyed, even though God could have saved it. And once he rebuilds its table, it's plain, even though if he wanted, he could have filled it with gold and silver.
So what is the function of the river coming out of the temple in chapter 47?
Well, here too, I can give different examples. Let's start with the one that's, I think, very concrete, and that is that a person, even if he gets a prophecy from God, he obviously gives it in words and in terms that people around him are familiar with. And Ezekiel is situated in Babylonia, and it's really a place full of rivers, and seeing water that's coming out of temples. We're familiar with that from Babylonian temples. Some of our listeners may have heard of the word apshu, which is really this water that springs out of Babylonian temples and has theological meanings to it that come with it. So one thing which I started saying was that really he's reacting to what he sees in his Babylonian context, which is people seeing waters coming out of the temple, seeing that water is significant, being in contact, in correspondence with Babylonian cities that all contained rivers and flowing springs, and that many of the water courses in Babylonian in Nebuchadnezzar's times have actually been mapped. And we can even follow and see them today, and we can see the water sources. And it's a whole huge issue in the Babylonian 5th or 6th century BCE. And it's obvious to me that Ezekiel was corresponding with what he saw around him. But I do want to say more than that. I want to say, and this goes one step further on the theological aspect that we talked about before. If you really deny access to the temple from any people who want to come to the temple, then you might want to think of an alternative for people to be able to connect this temple or to feel some of its presence around or within them. And I think it's very interesting the fact that there's actually water that comes out of the temple. And what we see from this water is basically something that I would say enables the people to benefit from the qualities of the temple, because the waters come out of the temple and then they flow down till Yam HaMelech, until the Dead Sea. And they have all these amazing qualities, meaning there's everlasting fruit and trees and healing and all these amazing benefits just by sitting next to the stream of water that comes out of the temple. So I think basically what we have here is really twofolded. On the one hand, we see a discussion in terms that are recognized and well known for the people who are familiar with Babylonian temples. Again, there's a Sagila, which is, I would say, Marduk built in his temple, which is the Marduk's temple is a Sagila, and he built, as I said before, the Apshu, the fresh deep waters from the underground. And I think that it was really that he considered it to be the dwelling place of his father, Ea. So, and we can go on and understand the qualifications of the Apshu. But I would just say in a nutshell that when Ezekiel water issues from under the threshold of the temple house, it corresponds with the gate of the Apshu house and the foundation of the platform of heaven and the underworld that it represents. And on the other hand, it's a way to enable the Israelites to connect to the temple, even not invited physically to come in.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So for the exiles in Babylon, what hope would this vision of Ezekiel's temple offer to them?
Wow, that's a huge question. What is the significance of this vision? First of all, we have to say explicitly that it was never built. The returnees who came back did not build a temple like Ezekiel. Not only did they not build a temple like Ezekiel's, they didn't even build a temple that was similar to the first temple. And we see that because in the book, the third chapter of the book of Ezra, we hear that the people that recognized this temple and compared it, or the temple that was going to be built and compared it to the first temple, were crying while others were laughing. So this mixture of laughing and crying actually shows the disappointment when the second temple was being built. And it makes it very clear that it was nothing like Ezekiel's visionary temple. So now we have to ask, not only did Ezekiel's visionary temple mean to the Babylonians, it's also, what did it mean? What was the reception history of this temple? Meaning there are two aspects to it that are connected. So for the Babylonians around Ezekiel, I actually think that this temple vision was part of what gave them legitimacy to stay in Babylonia and later to be part of the Persian Empire. Meaning, they were probably ambivalent towards what was happening in Israel, towards building of the second temple, trying to figure out at first if 70 years really passed, which was the prophecy of Jeremiah and noted also in Daniel and noted also in Ezra for when the second temple should be built after the first temple was destroyed. So first they were asking themselves, did the time come? And once they were convinced the time came, they saw there was no rain and it was very hard to really build a second temple in such hard circumstances. So I would say this vision actually added to the other reasons that they told themselves, this, what's going on in Israel is not the real thing. We just heard what the real thing looks like. We heard it, 25 years after the temple was destroyed when Ezekiel gave this visionary prophecy, and he described something that looks nothing like what's going on now under Cyrus's declarations, post his declaration, his agreement in Israel. So I would say the first thing would be justification to stay in Babylon. The second thing would be, since Ezekiel predicted the first temple's being destroyed and the destruction of the first temple, when they basically didn't believe him that it would happen, they thought to themselves, oh, we already heard prophets telling us the temple will fall, and it never did. It always stayed. The days of Sancharib are the famous example for that. So in 701 BC. So they really never thought the temple would be really destroyed, and no one would really be there to live in Jerusalem with God being there. That wasn't something that they thought would actually materialize, even after they were exiled to Babylonia 12 years before the temple was destroyed. So the fact that Ezekiel had credibility, and he could say, well, you know, I told you the temple, God left the temple and the temple would be destroyed, and it really happened, gave this visionary temple also credibility. Meaning now he could tell them, you know, I was right then, I'll be right again here too. Wait to see. Now, this didn't happen yet, so they didn't see it. But I do think they felt that this is something that's reasonable, might happen, and they should be waiting for, because this prophet already proved himself right once. So that's for the Babylonian, the Judeans that exiled Babylonia. But I think that the question you ask is a larger question. We have to ask ourselves, what did this visionary temple plan do throughout the 600 years of the Second Temple? I mean, imagine this. There stood a temple in Jerusalem, nothing like this vision, nothing like the first temple. It took, I don't know, 400 or 500 years until it became even a substantial building. I mean, there's a period of time there that we don't know a lot about, but after the biblical times and before we have Second Temple information and rabbinic texts. But on all, I can say that there was never a time that the Second Temple really was magnificent or substantial, or was a central, obvious place for Jews all around in diaspora too. We know that there were Jews who stayed in Babylonia and Persia and in Egypt, and we know that they didn't, you know, think they have to apologize for not coming. So I think that this visionary plan in Jewish thought was kind of the alternative plan. One day, if this project, current project, the Second Temple building is not working, we have an alternative plan. One day it'll materialize. So I think that's why it was so substantial, because it kind of gave Jews throughout the years of the Second Temple, especially those that were disappointed or frustrated or just didn't feel that what was happening in Israel could have been this real project that God meant to be his recognition in the world, something to hold on to and to say, well, we have a plan B in the drawer. One day it'll materialize.
Now, the holidays look a bit different in Ezekiel's vision than they do in Moses' Torah. So what's going on there?
So here's another excellent example of the way that Ezekiel's temple is really different from what we're familiar with. We discussed before the fact that there's really an absence of holy vessels. And I think that the fact that we don't have no hint of an ark, of Kruvim, I mean, we have some Kruvim decorating walls, but no real Kruvim. We don't have any table for showbread. There's no menorah. All that is explicitly lacking, I say anything explicit is lacking, really has to do later with what we can say about the holidays. Because, you know, part of what we do on a Yom Kippur, according to custom, if we would understand it from what was expected in the rabbinic literature and what was described in the first temple, was going into the Holy of Holiness, doing certain, you know, rituals that have to do with vessels that were actually situated within the temple. So the first thing I want to say is that when you have very few vessels in the temple, you know, the holiday rituals cannot be the same, because, you know, there's just not the same infrastructure to really carry out the same rituals. But I also want to say more than that. What's most, to my mind, strange, or what really gives us this notion that something's different, is on the one hand the fact that we're lacking a Rosh Hashanah and a Yom Kippur, the first day of the seventh month and the tenth day of the seventh month, which are usually meant to be extremely substantial holidays in the Jewish cycle of holidays. I want to be fair and say again that some commentators say, you know, that doesn't mean that they were lacking. The fact that they're not written explicitly just means that, you know, such kind of holidays must have taken place. There was nothing specific to say about them. Okay, that could be the case. As I said before, it's not my personal opinion. But I do think that it has to do again with the fact that the people really are not invited. And what we really see instead of holidays that really used to be in the first temple and also the rabbinic texts in the second temple, a lot about all the Israelites coming to the temple, we don't really see that anymore. And it has to do again with the fact that if you don't want anyone to make this temple impure, then you really have to make sure there's no reason to come in masses to the temple. What is interesting, that he adds another, I would say, it's not exactly holiday, it's more like a ritual, on the first day of the first month, the first day of Nisan, and then on the 14th day. And it's a ritual that's basically meant to be like a cleaning day or a preparation day, purifying day before Passover. Now here also, some of the commentators say this is not a regular ritual. This is not a first month temple ritual like I'm describing it. This is more a ceremony that's, you know, the first time that the temple was opened, this is how they opened it. But I think if you read carefully the verses, you'll actually see that this was a regular ritual that happened on the first day of the first month. And I think that it has to do with the fact that he was really very, very clear about having to make sure everything's very pure. So that's why we get a new ritual that's all about purifying the temple. Now, I want to say more than that. I want to say that it also has to do with the what was regulated in these days of the month in the Babylonian context, because there are two things that are similar here. First of all, the timing. There was a known festival called the Akitu Festival that used to happen in the first month and the seventh month in parallel times, and it included many demonstrations in the streets and was very popular, and people well recognized it. So I think here too, Ezekiel may be responding to known customs that maybe part of the Judeans in exile started watching, participating, corresponding with. So he's giving the Jewish alternative to these dates. And I'll say more than that, that in the Kitu festival, there was a lot to do with opening and closing the temple gate. And part of what we see in Ezekiel, surprisingly, touches on the same kind of elements, meaning the Nabunadis, which was really, the Babylonian describing him, would describe doors, posts, and locks, and vaults, and, you know, different aspects of the temples and how they were opened and closed and what exactly were done with them. And it's interesting that Ezekiel also all of a sudden touches on all these details that, in different contexts, we might have thought that they were totally irrelevant. But bottom line, there's a common denominator, which is in both places, there's a God who moved from an area that was profane or that was that didn't enable him to be there in a proper manner into an area now made sacred by his presence. And the purifying of a temple on the first day of the seventh month, I think is the biblical, you can say, response or correspondence or context to understand the way that Ezekiel really interacted with his Babylonian surroundings, and was also another way to really see that he was familiar with his Babylonian surroundings. And he really felt that there had to been kind of a respond to what people saw in the culture around them. So I would say that on the one hand, he really charts an individual path, but On the other hand, his individual path is really contextualized. And that's why I call the book Ezekiel's Visionary Temple in Babylonian Context, because I really felt that that's the new point I'm trying to make, that even when you want to chart an individual path, even when you have your own priorities, and in Ezekiel's prophecies, it's very obvious, the overriding concern with preserving the sanctity, the holiness, the purity of the future temple, even that is said in terms and in correspondence, taking into consideration the Babylonian context. I'll say that I really tried to end the book with when I was thinking of really the exile's effect on the people who were exiled to Babylonia and their worldview, their theological view, the way that they were trying to understand the fact that they were exiled from their homeland, what that meant, and asking themselves, will they come back? And I think that if we try to put ourselves in their place and we try to think what a prophet would have to address living among them, what kind of questions would be at stake, then I think then understanding that really helps us articulate why Ezekiel emphasizes this driving theological force and this intense desire to safeguard the sanctity of the future temple. And I think that way he's really corresponding to the exiles, maybe debates or maybe a hesitance with the question of, will there be another temple? How should we understand the first temple's fate? What would be the end of this, or where will this bring us? And when you see the way he replies to these questions and he addresses what's at stake, I'll say that really understanding the driving theological force of the book of Ezekiel, where he really wants to be a safeguard and make sure that the sanctity of the future temple, its holiness, its purity, will be kept forever. And in that way, I think he's really trying to respond to what the exiles may have been wondering about. How are they going to make sure that the fate of the first temple won't actually repeat itself in any future temple they may build? So I would say in a nutshell, or to sum up, that when we examine this visionary temple against the backdrop of the Babylonia and the Judeans, meaning if we take into consideration what we know today, which is pretty much about the Babylonian culture and about the Judeans and where they were exiled to, and we understand that they lived also in rural, but also in urban communities, and how they interacted with, I think, not only the Babylonian people and the Babylonian industry, if you can call an industry, to farms and to, agriculture, but also with the rituals and the way the temples looked, and they saw the priests, and they knew exactly what it looks like to have a magnificent temple. They really got a response from Ezekiel, because on the one hand, he gives them a prophecy where he really departs in significant ways, from the temples they see around them, but also from the first temple. And he really starts a new path. But from another point of view, he really interacts with what has been the Jewish past, with what they see around them. So on the one hand, it's like, I would say, isolated, but on the other hand, it's extremely contextualized. And I think that it's really an amazing response, what the people in Babylonia were probably wondering. It's a complex one. It can be looked at from different perspectives. It can be looked at from the current years where he was prophesizing, and from reception history throughout different periods, especially the time of their attorneys when they were building the second temple. And this really helps us understand maybe part of their frustration. But it's also another way of really understanding how Jews interacted, not only with, I would say, day-to-day interactions that had to do with taxes and had to do with being ruled by other empires, but also interacted theologically, trying to give a response to where they are, why they are unique, what makes their theological notion different, and what ways does it correspond with what they see around them.
I find it fascinating that the Essenes of Qumran, in their temple scroll and other places, clearly use Ezekiel's temple vision as the paradigm for the sort of temple city they would like to see Jerusalem become. What do you make of that?
I think that's an excellent example of the fact that the Ezekiel's temple kept being an option on the table, and actually an option to correspond with. And if there's something we learn from it, it's how little they thought of the current temple that they saw in Jerusalem while writing these texts, yearning for a totally different one.
Tova, it's been a delight once more to speak with you about your work. All the best to you.
Thank you. It's always a treat to be here. And I really hope that there's something that we can learn from the Judeans in exile, is that even in a time that they really felt a big loss to their temple and their homeland, they still were grappling with the big questions, with where is God? What will the future bring them? 2,500 years have passed. But I can say that I think if there's something I've taken, it's to continue grappling with big questions and really strive and hope to find an answer and not feel that they're beyond our reach, even if the responses we can come up with are only a fraction of a big picture, only if they give us one piece of the puzzle. It's still very important to strive there. And I think if the people who are these Judeans in exile, still mourning for their loss, could really demand some kind of response from the prophet within them, then it's for us also to continue demanding from ourselves maybe some kind of responses.
Friends, you've been listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Until next time, goodbye.